from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Deborah Threedy knows plenty has been written about Joe Hill. He's the activist and labor troubadour who became a martyr when he was executed by the state of Utah in 1915. And Deborah knows there's been a play, there's been a musical, there's been a movie, a documentary, lots of books. So why write something else about Joe Hill? Well, a few reasons, she says. There are women in this story, and she wanted to explore that. But Deborah says she also wanted to write about Joe Hill because of the Wobblies, the union Joe was so passionate about. They were activists, but also poets and comics and songwriters. And the things they were singing and speaking about, social justice, income disparity, class inequality, Deborah says all of those things are still with us. So she wrote another play about Joe Hill, and it's playing in Salt Lake City. Today in the program, we're talking about it. So we invite you to join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. How many of you know the story of Joe Hill? If you've lived here for any amount of time, you've heard the name. You may even know the basic story. And the basic story is this, that Joe Hill, this young, fiery labor activist who wrote dozens of songs about the struggle of the working class, was convicted of murdering a Salt Lake City grocer and his son in 1914. He was eventually executed by a Utah firing squad. Now, the story never really ended with Hill's death. There were questions about the investigation, about the fairness of the trial. There were rumors and references to shadowy figures and conspiracies. Hill became a celebrated figure, a martyr to the cause of organized labor, and Utah took a hit as the state that killed him. You can find the story in lots of places. There's a musical, there's a film, a documentary, there are books and songs and poems, and there have been other plays. But now there's another one, this one by playwright and legal scholar Deborah Threedy. And why, you ask, do we need another play about Joe Hill? Well, it's a good question. We'll ask Deborah today. Her play, One Big Union, has just opened in Salt Lake City. It's a production of the Plan B Theater Company, so we're talking about it today. Deborah Threedy is with us here in the studio, a playwright, as I said, whose work has been performed around the state. She's written plays about Everett Roos, about Wallace Stegner, both premiered with the Plan B Theater Company. She's also a law professor at the University of Utah, though we should mention she's retiring at the end of the school year. Deborah Threedy, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jeremy Harmon is also with us. He's director of photography at the Salt Lake Tribune, has kind of an obsession with Joe Hill. He curates and wrote much of the Tribune's webpage on the legacy of Joe Hill. He's researching a book on Joe Hill as well. And Jeremy, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Plan B Theater Company has sold out its performances of One Big Union. We'll give you waiting list information, though, as we go along. Deborah, wow, sold out.
Yep.
Why do you figure?
Well, I mean, name recognition, right?
Yeah.
Everybody knows Joe or wants to know about Joe.
So. What do you figure, and Jeremy, I want to get you on this question too. What is it about the story that interests people? I mean, there's this sense of social justice and there's a lot of sort of idealism and romance, but what is it that people find so interesting around here, do you think, about that story?
I think you're right with the social justice, that Joe, for many people, is a symbol of a failure of the system, of speaking truth to power, no matter what the consequences. On top of it, there's a lot of mystery around him, not just did he do it or not, but there are huge chunks of his life that we don't know exactly where he was or what he was doing. So a man of mystery.
Yeah. Jeremy, what is it for you that interests you?
I'd echo a lot of what Deborah just said. I mean, there's the social justice thing is a huge part of it. The mystery is part of it. You start digging into this story and, enough little nuggets pop up here and there that it's like, geez, maybe somebody can finally figure out, get the definitive thing that proves what happened. And it's just, it's such a fascinating story. And in a lot of ways, it's got so many parallels with what's going on currently in the United States. And so you just see all this stuff. It's like, wow, it's an old story. It's a new story.
Yeah. Deborah, the parallels to today, that interests you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was freaky working on it because, you know, things would happen and they would have resonance with what I was working on. And it's absolutely a story that speaks today. I mean, police brutality, yeah. Police misconduct, the rush to judgment, the idea that we scapegoat people who belong to
shadowy parties,
right,
figures we don't understand.
Just the gross income disparity that existed in the 19-teens and that we see ever increasing today, where fewer and fewer people in this country have more and more of the wealth.
Yeah.
It's pretty freaky how much it echoes.
Jeremy, when did you sort of strike on this story, though? When did you start to become interested in looking into the story of Joe Hill?
Well, it's one of the, I'd always kind of known about it, right? Because how do you not know about it here?
Yeah.
But a few years back, I read my first biography on it. I thought it was really interesting. And then about 2 years ago, the idea came up at the Tribune to do a big project to mark the 100-year anniversary of the execution. And I'd read some books and things, and so I thought I knew a lot about it. And so I was like, oh, well, blah, 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 blah. And in one of the meetings I was in, and it was basically, well, Jeremy knows some stuff about this, so why don't you help? And I was like, that'd be great.
Yeah.
And then we started digging and digging, and we just – yeah, and I haven't been able to put it down. It's been 2 years, but it's I just – it to me, it's just endlessly fascinating.
Well, one of the things you've said, and I thought this was interesting, is that part of what interested you about this is that – it kind of played out not that far from where you live.
Yeah, I live, you know, I live close to Sugar House Park, and that's where he was executed. And it's just like, holy smokes, like that's where I take my kids to play.
Yeah.
Like, weird, right? And then right downtown, you know, the Tribune's office is, you know, we're down in the gateway, and the funeral parade ended at the train station there. It's Urban Outfitters now. Like, I can go down and buy pants where they had his funeral.
Yeah.
Like, that's just really weird, right? It's pretty fascinating.
I want to just, for those who aren't, I mean, I gave some of the basics to the story, but would you just take us through, let's take just a few minutes and tell the basics of this story and the holes in the story as you see them. Jeremy, you start. So it's like 1914. He's accused of, there is a grocer and his son who are sort of murdered in cold blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so John and Arling Morrison get killed in the store. The thought is that Arling got a shot off at one of the attackers.
Yeah.
Joe shows up at a doctor's office with a bullet hole.
Late at night.
Yeah, in his chest that night. A few days later, the doctor sees that, you know, the police are looking for somebody who's been shot. So Joe's arrested. He's charged. He's eventually convicted. There's a lot of controversy about all of it because there were three other people who showed up at doctor's offices with gunshot wounds that night. And so
there were a lot of gunshot wounds going on.
Salt Lake City was the wild, wild west.
It was,
it really was. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's important to consider is it
wasn't. It seems dicey today. Like if you look at that story in the context of today, like 11 o'clock at night, a guy shows up. He's got a gunshot wound. It just so happened that, like, it would seem a little cagey. But if you put it in the context of those times that, as you said, there were other
guns. It was a Saturday night in Salt Lake City,
right?
Like,
right,
it was.
Right. Guns are going off.
Yeah. It was. And so, anyway, yeah, the controversy kind of starts right there. There were three other possible suspects. There's all these things going on, and so the controversy starts almost immediately.
Yeah. And I think the most maddening part of the story, I think, for people who believe Joe Hill did it or believe that he didn't, was the fact that he would not say
how he got shot.
Like, that is such a crucial story, and he kept his mouth shut about it. Deborah, why do you? I mean, we'll sort of work through this as we go along, but that's the sort of the hardest part of the story to deal with, it seems.
Well, but it's also, from a playwright's perspective, it's the most interesting and fascinating piece of it because, if you think he's guilty, the reason he keeps his mouth shut is obvious.
Yeah.
He doesn't have anything to say.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You know, but if he's innocent and he keeps his mouth shut, why? And so the challenge for me as a playwright was constructing a world and a scenario where it would make sense for him to keep his mouth shut.
Yeah.
Or at least a sense to him, maybe not to us, but that becomes coherent with who he is and what he believes.
Yeah, I want to come back to that because I think that is a big question, why both of you think, in fact, that he did. And by keep his mouth shut, he didn't say how – well, he said that he had been in a dispute with a friend.
Over a woman.
They got in the fight, escalated, and the guy shot him. And that's the story. But he refused to name the name of the friend
or the name of the woman.
Yeah. Okay. So, Deborah, again, let me get back to that initial question. Why do we need another play or anything about Joe Hill?
Well, I mean, you mentioned one earlier on. Nobody's really paid attention to the women in Joe's story, particularly Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, yeah. Who I'd heard of. I think Barry Stavis's play, I think she's a character, but it's a minor character in the play. And I had been doing research on Joe, and when I got to the point where I actually pulled up his letters and was reading his letters, I was struck by the depth of his emotional connection with Elizabeth that comes through in the letters.
Yeah.
And that to me was fascinating. They didn't know each other before he was arrested, although they were both wobblies. They were both active.
Explain what wobblies are, by the way, for just those who don't know.
The industrial workers of the world. People get the name wrong a lot,
but
it's the industrial workers of the world, the IWW. And
he was a wobbly. That was
he was a lot wobbly. Yeah. She was a wobbly. Once he's arrested, she becomes active in his defense, and she starts a correspondence with him. And the correspondence goes on, you know, for over a year. And then finally they meet in Salt Lake City. She's traveling through on her way to the West Coast, and she stops off, and they actually meet for an hour. And she writes about it in her memoir. So it was, why hasn't anybody focused on that piece of the story? And so that became a crucial part of the story I wanted to tell. But then in addition, Bill Adler is his book 2011? Is that when he published it?
That sounds right.
Yeah. He published a biography on Joe Hill, and he had found some information about a possibility for who the woman was that hadn't been explored before.
Yeah.
And so
this shadowy woman we don't know about.
Yeah. And we don't know for sure who it was. There are some other candidates, but I decided to go with the one that Bill identifies, which is Hilda Erickson.
Hilda Erickson. Well, now we'll come back to both of these women. I want to talk a little bit about more. But this raises this question. Is this play a piece of fiction? Is it you taking some license with a story? Is this you proposing a theory? Is it your spin? Is it a little bit of all of those things? Like, how do you describe what this play is?
It's a little bit of all of those things. I mean, there are a lot of lines that are Joe's and not mine. And in fact, I would say any line that particularly strikes you or makes you laugh is probably Joe's and not mine.
Is that right? He was a funny guy.
He was.
He was a funny guy, actually. Yeah.
And I was driving the other day, and I was thinking about a particular scene, and I actually couldn't remember if I wrote that or if Joe wrote that. So they've become blurred in my mind. But it's not a documentary.
Nope.
It does not make a claim to historical truth. In that sense, it is a fictional work. However, and I've done this sort of amalgamation of my writing and others, you know, historical writings before. And what I try to do is not include any fact that is demonstrably false. But if a fact is disputed, I get to choose, you know, which way to go. And, of course, there are always holes in the historical record.
Right.
And the play is really about trying to fill in those holes.
Yeah.
And so that's creative, imaginative, non-historical.
Yeah. Jeremy, is there anything wrong with that? It's interesting because you've talked about how you kind of were – I think maybe this is how you've described it to us, is that you were a little skeptical going into the play, but you seem to see some value in sort of processing these ideas like Deborah has.
You know, I really enjoyed the play.
Yeah.
I really did. And Deborah, I did kind of come in with my arms folded, like, okay, let's see what this is going to be
right.
like. Because
I know the story. Or I know what is
– Yeah, right? It's like, yeah. You know, I've got a background in this. Like, yep. I know what happened. I also, you know, I was able to see – like, I know what Deborah was basing everything on in the play. And so you know, I might have some minor nerd quibbles with some of the scenes and some of the depictions and things like that. But overall, I mean, I think it's a really good introduction to the story. You know, my quibbles would be like if you talk to a hardcore Trekkie about J.J. Abrams stuff. You know, it's like, oh, come on, man.
right?
Like, it's that's kind of where I'm at with it, I think. So,
but the idea of her working through this idea, I guess you see as value.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are so many holes that you kind of have to make some jumps here and there, you know, and like there's a lot of different theories on why Joe didn't speak up that night, you know, and I've developed some of my own and I have to own them as my own. Like
because no one knows.
Yeah. No one knows. I kind of like my theories and I, you know, but you know, it's me trying to fill in gaps.
I want to ask about a couple of elements of the play.
Sure.
I like how you've included a kind of a chorus figure.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who sort of are familiar with sort of Greek theater, there was always a sort of an everyman sort of figure, a chorus figure. Sometimes it was multiple. You've included a figure or a character by the name of the working stiff.
Right.
Who's sort of your everyman.
Yeah, he's a wobbly everyman.
Yeah. Talk about that role. The role that he plays. Yeah, I guess he's telling us the story.
So in early drafts, there were a lot more characters in the play, a lot more characters. Haywire McKinlock, who we'd been talking about earlier, appeared.
Oh, I hear two nerds talking about those names.
Ed Rowan was more of a character. I mean, just, you know, every historical name that popped up in the story was a character. Hmm. And then at some point I went, Jerry's going to kill me.
You know, because Jerry Rapier is the
director, and it's a small theater, and it's, you know, bare bones
so
budget.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
You know.
Can I just say thank you for cutting McClintock?
So you had to pare it down.
Well, what I started doing is rather than thinking of all these people as individual characters, I started thinking of how could I come up with a unified voice that would be making all the points these people were making, not necessarily in their words, but – and that person evolved into the working stiff. And that character has really evolved over the course of working on the play to where it is today.
It's interesting to read the play. I haven't seen it yet. And this is always true of any play. It's different on the stage than it is on the page. But I think this is quite different because there are these pantomimes.
Yep.
There's this use of masks and props and kind of these routines. There's choreography. There's movement.
There is indeed. And thank heavens for Stephanie Howell because she's done an amazing job with that. She was the choreographer for the play. Not in the sense of a, you know, musical theater choreography.
No, no, no. And it's not necessarily
all
dance, but there's how does movement work in the play?
Amazingly. She got exactly what I was hoping for. If you've read the script, it's not as prop heavy in execution as it was in my imagination. There is a lot of pantomime. There's a lot of movement.
It's very stylized.
Very stylized. The ongoing idea here is that we're in a union hall and the cast is the people in the union hall, and they're actually just kind of goofing around, playing with these songs and acting them out in the way you would if you were being silly with a bunch of your friends.
I want to play a piece of music as we head into a break, because we should say that one of the things you mentioned in the notes of the play is this is not a musical, but it is a play with music.
A lot of music.
Yeah. And I guess that makes sense. Of course, Joe Hill, that was his main way of expressing himself.
Absolutely.
So the role of music then is just these songs. Again, it's not a musical, but they're relevant in the sort of various moments.
Yes.
Of the scenes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They pick up something and echo something, or they help with a transition. I mean, the reason for the songs, and this is Joe speaking, not me. He once wrote in a letter how, you know, a speech is only heard once. Yeah. A pamphlet, no matter how well written, is only read once. But a song is learned by heart and is repeated over and over again. And it's that direct connection to the heart that Joe's songs achieve then and now.
Tell us about the song "There Is Power," because this sort of creates something of a theme for the show.
Yes, of all of Joe's, and I read the text of Joe's songs, but it wasn't until I really got into the weeds, and in fact discovered a website that has recordings of all of Joe's songs on it, that I could actually hear them as well as read the words. And the one that immediately grabbed me was "There Is Power," because it kind of sums up one big union. There is power, and a band of working folk.
Well, we'll hear this a bit of music as we head into a break. Deborah Threedy is with us. She wrote "One Big Union." She's a law professor at the University of Utah. Jeremy Harmon is with us. He's been reporting on Joe Hill for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's researching a book. Plan B Theater Company's "One Big Union" runs through Sunday. I mentioned earlier the performances are sold out, but I think they have a wait list. So you can go to our website to find out about that, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then join in the grand industrial band. Would you from misery and hunger be free? Then come to your share, lend a hand. There is power in a band of working folk when they stand hand in hand.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the labor activist and martyr Joe Hill, executed by Utah Firing Squad 101 years ago this month. The Plan B Theater Company has produced a play that explores Hill's trial and his execution. Deborah Threedy is a playwright, also happens to be a legal scholar, and she says whether Joe Hill was guilty of murder or not, it's pretty clear he didn't get a fair trial. So the play explores what went wrong, efforts to save him. It's lots of music because, of course, it's Joe Hill. Deborah Threedy is with us here in the studio. The play opened already. It runs through the weekend. It's sold out, but there's a wait list, and you can get details about that on our website. We also have with us Jeremy Harmon, who has his own obsession about Joe Hill. He's been writing about it for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's researching a book as well. He's also joining us here in the studio. Okay, so I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about, I think what's so interesting is how the establishment, how the police, the governor, others, what they made of the fact that Joe Hill was a wobbly. Because people were really sort of freaked out about the Wobblies. And this seems to have played a really important part in this story. Like, this wasn't just an ordinary guy. This was the way they sort of demonized, this whole idea of socialism and communism and whatever, all that stuff, you know, people are weird about that anyway. But Jeremy, maybe talk a little bit about the role that played in this story overall.
I think it plays the role in this story overall. So the IWW really started becoming active in Salt Lake City as early as 1911. And in 1913, things had really come to a head. And I'll keep this very short, but IWW had just won a big strike against the Utah Construction Company, which it was the Eccles family at the time, right?
Wow.
And they were having a victory rally downtown, and some of the Eccles Company guards actually attacked the rally. A big riot breaks out, And so they went from being kind of a nuisance to being like they were really viewed as a threat. And it's really remarkable to go back and read the stories at the time, because there's no question who started the fight. It was these company guards coming down and attacking the rally, but they're heralded as these heroes. And there's this really patriotic twist put on it. And for the next several years, when they're talking about the IWW, this this riot that ensued because of this attack is talked about as a reason to be scared of the IWW, even though they weren't the ones who started the fight. You know, it was totally pinned on them.
Yeah.
They're a minority group, largely immigrants. And so they were scapegoated on this thing. And the people who actually initiated the problem, that this violent act, were heralded as heroes. And so it's pretty fascinating.
You want to say something about that? I think that really comes through in the play, this idea that, I mean, look, it is interesting that what Joe Hill seemed to say about that, because there's a scene that we'll come to here in a moment where he's like, look, I just happened to be a poor sap who was wrong place at the wrong time. It has nothing to do with the union.
He moved into Salt Lake City about 2 weeks after that riot happened.
Yeah.
And 4 months later, he's in jail.
Yeah. So what do you make of that?
Well,
that question.
Yeah. I mean, at one level, I understand why Joe says this has nothing to do with the union. When I first heard that Joe had been executed, you know, for murder, I figured it was a death that had occurred during a strike or, you know, a rally or something like that, because it was actually pretty common across the country for Wobblies to be accused of murder if somebody died during a strike. It was always their fault. They were the ones who were striking. Therefore, anybody died, it's their fault. And so when I actually, the first time I went to look up Joe Hill and found out the circumstance of the murder, I went, wow, this really has nothing to do with labor. The murder is not part of a strike or a rally or any kind of labor activity. So it was different in that way. And I think Joe was probably acutely sensitive of that and was perhaps even trying to keep the union out of it,
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, whatever fallout happened, it didn't go to the union. But nobody else would unhook those two. So Joe was always being branded as a Wobbly, one of those dangerous people, the menace to society. And that was just how they were seen then.
This gets us to a scene. This is an exchange. I know I'll play another moment. This is Joe and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, this relationship that you're interested in, Deborah. We've shortened it a bit for time, but she's talking about, on one hand, she talks about the importance of his music.
Yeah.
And maybe you could say something about that, the way you've reflected it here in the play is he's kind of taken aback by how much impact his music seems to have had.
Right. Which, again, is the, at least, you know, whether it was false modesty or not, was the tact he took in his letters with her,
yeah.
You know, saying, oh, no, I'm not that important. But I think what it's kind of important to remember is, you know, today the idea of singing during a strike or a protest is just sort of our cultural vocabulary.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was back then.
Hmm.
I think the Wobblies' decision to incorporate songs into their strike activity was somewhat novel.
Okay, so here... Well, all right, let's play this moment. This is Joe and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. We'll hear Roger Dunbar and Tracy Merrill in those roles. A scene from Deborah Threedy's play, One Big Union.
Joe Hill, the poet laureate of labor, the troubadour of discontent. After being pen pals for so long, we finally meet. Oh, Joe, how are you doing? Are you well?
I'm doing okay, Miss Flynn.
Oh, no, you don't. My friends call me Gurley, and so shall you.
Gurley?
Gurley, with a U. It's my mother's name.
Well, I like that. Gurley. It suits you.
I think you like the pun.
Maybe. Well, tell me, what's going on out there? What actions are brewing? I feel so useless stuck in this hole.
Useless? You? I wonder, do you even realize how important your songs are?
Important? No, I wouldn't.
Oh, I wish you had been in Lawrence. That strike was the first strike I ever saw that sang. The workers sang as they marched down the streets. They sang on the picket lines. They sang as the cops hauled them away. And they sang in the holding cells. And it was amazing. Those songs had power in them. The power to weld all these different people into one. 25,000 men and women. 50 nationalities. 44 different languages. And when they opened their mouths and sang, they all spoke one language. Those songs ignited a fire. A peculiar, intense fire. And that fire was dangerous. I've never felt anything like it at any other strike anywhere. And you know whose songs they were singing, don't you? Yours.
A Little Talk with Golden.
Yes, the song you wrote for us, and Long-Haired Preachers, and Mr. Block, and Casey Jones. All of them. They were singing your songs.
No, I'm afraid you're giving me more glory than I'm entitled to.
No, I'm telling you how it is. No,
I'm just one of the rank and file. Just a common Pacific wharf rat, that's all. Trying to be true to my friends and my class. Local 92, Portland.
Local 179, New York.
I wish we were meeting in an action and not here.
We all pay our dues behind bars.
But not for murder.
In Lawrence, they arrested Eder and Giovanniti for murder. One of the strikers, Annie Lapizzo, was shot in cold blood by the cops, but they said the leaders agitating caused it.
Oh, that was different. Those arrests were in retaliation for organizing. The murder of this grocer had nothing to do with labor.
Is that why you didn't want our help? Because you thought it had nothing to do with labor?
Yes, it's my problem, not the union's.
The murder of the poor grocer and his son had nothing to do with labor, but accusing you? That has everything to do with labor, with who you are.
No, it has to do with picking a scapegoat. And it was my bad luck to get shot the same night he was murdered. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. They picked me as their prime suspect because I wasn't from here. Just a dumb Swede and a drifter. As good a scapegoat as anyone.
And the best-known wobbly songsmith in the country.
They didn't know that when they arrested me.
Maybe, maybe not, but they found out pretty quick.
Now, to them, it was just icing on the cake.
Put aside the wobbly thing. Say you aren't one. It's still a class battle. Say you are just some poor schmuck. If you weren't part of the working class, if you weren't unemployed, scratching for a living, you wouldn't be here now.
Jeremy Harmon, do you think he believed that? That it was had nothing to do with labor?
I do, initially.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, there's a little nuance on it, too, though. I think more than it having nothing to do with labor, I really think he wanted to keep the union out of it. Like, if you consider Joe's travels through the West. He was in a lot of places where there were really serious confrontations with authorities and police and things like that. And the IWW always came out on the losing end. And so when
he was protecting the union,
that's my take on it.
So, I mean, what does that say about him? That really speaks to his sort of level of integrity, I think, right?
Well, and it's. I think it's true of most Wobblies, too. It's like one of their real strong slogans is an injury to one is an injury to all. And so they're all really in the fight together. And there's plenty of stories where people get expelled from the union because they don't live up to that standard.
Solidarity.
Yeah, exactly.
And, of course, by inclination and training, I'm almost playing devil's advocate and looking at both sides. If Joe is guilty, he has a lot of incentive not to get the union involved in it. Just saying.
Yeah. Yeah, you do raise these questions. Let's talk about his lawyers, his legal representation.
And that's another instance where the limitations of the dramatic form demanded some tinkering with history. Joe actually had two trial lawyers.
Right.
One is Ernie McDougall, who is a complete novice, and the other, whose name I've forgotten, Jeremy probably remembers.
Soren Christensen? Is that who?
No.
The other one? I'm blanking on
Frank
the,
something.
Yeah.
Out and out crook. You know, just bad guy, just bad guy.
Neither of them were any good.
Right, yeah.
You've sort of distilled them into one figure, this Ernest McDougall. There's a moment here. I want to play this scene where we hear from Ernie McDougall, this inexperienced attorney. Let's play this moment. You'll hear Carlton Bluford, he's the working stiff. That's
right.
the narrator. Jay Perry, the actor, of course, who plays Ernie McDougall, and then Roger Dunbar, who you've heard, of course, is Joe Hill. Here's another moment from the play, A Big Union.
There is a non-conspiracy explanation for what happened to Joe. Pipe-smoking professor types who sit in their library studying this say that convictions of innocent people tend to share certain characteristics, and Joe's case has a lot of them. A high-visibility crime, eyewitness testimony, police misconduct, a defendant who is an outsider who belongs to some unsavory group, and inexperienced attorneys.
Hello there.
Yeah?
Ernie McDougal.
Joe Hill, but I think you knew that.
I did. I've been reading about your case in the papers.
Don't believe everything you read.
I don't. You are the Joe Hill of Mr. Block fame, aren't you?
Guilty as charged.
That's a great song. In fact, I like all your songs. Which is why I'm here. The paper said you didn't have an attorney. Well, I'm an attorney, and I would like to take your case.
I can't afford an attorney.
You can afford me, because I won't charge you anything.
Well, you'd work for free.
Uh-huh.
Where's the future in that?
You want the high-minded explanation or the pragmatic one?
Well, let's start with the pragmatic.
I'm new in town. Your case is going to be in the headlines. Free advertising for me.
Provided you do a good job.
Which I will.
And the high-minded?
I'm on your side.
My side? And which side is mine?
I'm for the working man.
Uh-huh. You a socialist?
Yes, and proud of it.
Yeah, well, socialism is just tinkering around the edges of capitalism. We will never win through the ballot box or through the courts. You don't look like you've ever worked with your hands.
Oh. My dad was a coal miner in Wyoming.
Uh-huh. Well, seeing as how your proposition is in perfect harmony with my bankroll, I accept.
What choice did he have, I guess.
Yeah.
But talk about how bad were these guys?
Bad.
And the other thing that is interesting to say is... Does he try to fire them in court in front
yes.
of the jury?
Yes, indeed he does.
I couldn't tell if that was if that part of the story or like the actual story.
That's
something...
part of the actual story.
Now, how good could that have looked to a jury? I mean, this was
not
pretty
good.
Terrible. So the optics are pretty crummy.
Yeah.
So he had bad representation.
He actually accuses his two defense attorneys of being prosecuting attorneys.
Right.
So yeah.
Trying to convict him. Yeah. And the truly ironic thing is that Joe had a better sense for what his lawyers should be doing than they had. He really, really got the idea of impeachment. In other words, the idea that just because somebody gets on the stand and under oath says, I saw or heard this, that a good lawyer will look at that skeptically and say, well, what exactly did you hear? How long, you know, was this going on? So, for example, his lawyers refused to cross-examine Merlin, the 13-year-old son of the grocer who was hiding in the back storeroom when his father and older brother were shot.
Yeah.
Okay. And
his story changed from the preliminary hearing testimony that he gave to the trial at the trial. Yeah.
And I mean, he says that he was looking through boxes and he's sawing all this, and the two men have hats on. They've got pulled down over their eyes. They've got bandanas covering most of their face. They've got long trench coats on. And yet he's saying that Joe kind of looks like one of those men, you know, and a good lawyer, even with a 13-year-old vulnerable kid that you don't want to start crying, because for sure you don't want him to do that. You could, well, you know, how long do you think he had to see him? You know, what exactly, what were the boxes like? You know, I mean, there are all sorts of ways you could have challenged that. In addition to Mrs. Seeley, who said she saw him on the street, and the other woman claims to have heard his voice and was able to identify his voice.
Through the one word, Bob.
Right. On a January night
when
it's freezing and she's inside with her doors and windows shut. A good lawyer would have brought all of that out to impeach the credibility of the witnesses, to say maybe they really think they saw this, but they really didn't see that much. They didn't hear that much. You can't really trust them. Joe had that sense that that's what should be going on, and his lawyers didn't, and that's why he fired them.
Yeah,
or tried to.
And then he said, "I want to represent myself."
Right. Mm-hmm.
Which, come on, you know that's a terrible idea. Usually,
yes, it is, and it would have been for Joe. Luckily, he didn't end up doing that. The court appoints his lawyer, even though he's fired the lawyer, which he's entitled to do.
which is interesting, of course, because he's not paying him. So, but anyway, the judge says, no, I want your lawyers to stay here and continue to act as your lawyers, as friends of the court. And Joe complains about that, but he loses that fight. Yeah. And so in fact, at least in the piece of the transcript, we don't have the entire transcript, but the piece of the transcript we have, it doesn't look like Joe actually did much questioning of witnesses.
Mm-hmm. How much of an effect did that have on things, obviously? I mean, you have a terrible group of representation. It must have – I mean, again, like – I guess it was a convergence of a lot of terrible things.
Yeah, the deck really couldn't have been more stacked against him. Nothing worked out in his favor through the legal process. You know, I mean, even again, starting with the arrest, it's just like everything that could have gone wrong really did go wrong through that process of it.
Jeremy Harmon is with us. He's been reporting on Joe Hill for the Salt Lake Tribune lately. He's researching a book. Deborah Threedy is with us. She wrote the play One Big Union. She's also a law professor at the University of Utah. Plan B Theater Company's One Big Union runs through Sunday. All the performances are sold out, I'm afraid, but there is a wait list. It opens for each show an hour before curtain. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are profiling the latest production from the Plan B Theater Company. It's Deborah Threedy's play, One Big Union. It's about the story of Joe Hill, kind of a mysterious story, really, in a lot of ways. Jeremy Harmon is also with us with the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been writing about Joe Hill. He's preparing a book, yet another book on the story of Joe Hill.
Yet another one.
Why not? Because there's so much we don't know about this story.
Yeah.
And are you waiting for a breakthrough?
No, I'm waiting to distill what I've got.
Yeah. Like
I've got too much information right now.
Yeah. So. You're sitting at the edge of your seat as we're talking about all this. So
I am.
That off the air. It's like it's hard to keep quiet. Let's talk about Hilda Erickson. Do you perceive this as a love story, or do you imagine it in some way? Is this like, because there is this question, right? Who was the woman he was trying to protect by keeping
right.
his mouth shut about the woman that he had supposedly fought over and gotten shot over?
Right.
Are you imagining that this is Hilda?
Yes, I am. I think from the letter that she wrote to Hahn, who at one point was Aubrey Hahn, was researching a book on Joe Hill, which was never published. She wrote him a letter, and it's clear she thinks she's the woman. Now, whether indeed she's the woman or not is debatable.
That's a humongo can of worms.
Yeah.
Well, because – and say what you mean, Jeremy, because there is some sense that she was a little – crazy. People said she held this crazy. Of course she wasn't, or she was. I mean, what's that about?
Well, so Hahn, he's working on this book and he's tracking down all these people who are involved in Joe's defense. And one of them is Hilda. You know, he wants to talk to her.
This is back in the '40s.
This is in 1940s. Like, and so, Hahn, in his letters, he really thinks it's this other woman. He thinks it's this woman named Maria Johansson. And like everybody's kind of working on that. And, anyway, he gets this letter from Hilda where she basically says, no, it's me. And so he starts writing to other people and say, you know, well, what's with this Hilda story? Is it her? And they're like, what? You know, like, what? She's like, well, that's crazy. None of us have heard this before. And, you know, so these are all people who are in that circle. I mean, she tells a really fascinating story in these letters. Whether or not that's true.
Who knows?
Who knows? Yeah, because the other people close to the story clearly don't believe her, which is pretty fascinating.
But what makes you think, Deborah, she's that woman or possibly could be that woman?
Well, I'm willing to take her at her word. And again, as a playwright, I'm making choices. So Maria Johansson is one possibility. But you know what? She's not a very nice person.
She's really not. Yeah, she's really not.
Hey, you two nerds. No one knows who Mary Jo – who is that?
She was a childhood friend of Joe's. She was living here in Salt Lake City, and they just happened to run into each other one day.
All right. Well, we don't need to go into that.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
you certainly don't in the play. But,
right, yeah, because, you know, from what I could read about her, I didn't like her. Yeah. I didn't want to spend time with her.
Hey, you're the playwright. That's your right.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I want to hear another moment here, and maybe we can talk about this scene, because Joe is talking to Hilda in this scene. And explaining to her, now she is, in your imagining, Deborah, she's said, let me testify.
Yes.
I can exonerate you. Now, Jeremy, I'm guessing you may quibble with that, because isn't there some part of the story that says Joe asked her to testify and she said she wouldn't, right?
No. Her story was that Joe told her not to.
I see.
And then there are letters from the time period that says her family was telling her not to come forward with anything. So.
But there's some sense that she wanted to anyway. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Here we hear Roger Dunbar and April Foss, and April plays Hilda Erickson from Deborah 3D's play, One Big Union.
Joe, let me testify. Tell your lawyer to call me as a witness.
No, I'm not going to do that.
If I ever not.
You look at that woman over there scribbling in her notebook. You see how she keeps glancing at us? She's a reporter. And you can bet your bottom dollar she's writing about us, wondering if you're that woman.
So what?
Have you read the papers? Do you see the filth they're writing about me? And look what they said about your uncles. They accused them of being criminals, part of my gang. They said your mother's house was the gang hideout. Can you imagine what they'd say about you?
It doesn't matter what they say.
They'd say you're just protecting your lover, that you're no better than you ought to be, that you're nothing but a slampa.
So? My friends know that's not true.
You could lose your job. That family you work for, they see that in the paper and you're gone.
I'm willing to take that chance.
I'm not. Back in Sweden, my mother... She was born out of wedlock, and for her entire life, even after she married, despite her faithful church attendance, the neighbors never let her forget it. They called her the whore's whelp, the bastard, until the day she died. I won't let them drag you down like that.
But Joe, what if I can help you?
That's just it, you can't. If you were called as a witness, what would you say? Come on, pretend you were on the stand, under oath, what would you say?
The truth. That Otto and I were engaged, but I broke it off. That Otto thought maybe it was because of you. That we went to the vaudeville that night, all four of us. That you were teasing Otto about me and that he was getting annoyed.
Did you hear Otto threaten me?
Well, no.
Did you see Otto shoot me?
No, of course not.
Did Otto tell you that he shot me?
I haven't seen Otto since that night. No one has. You know that.
Then how would anything you could say help?
It might. I could say you were at the show, that I was with you that evening.
Well, do you know where I was at 9:45 when the Morrisons were shot?
Well, no. We'd said goodnight earlier than that.
Do you know for a fact that I didn't shoot the Morrisons?
You told me you didn't. You told me Otto shot you.
And if you tried to say that, the prosecutor would be on his feet yelling, objection, hearsay, and the judge would agree. They wouldn't let you say what I told you.
I could say I know you. That you would never do something like that.
Hilda, that would just invite them to say you're biased. To insinuate we were more than friends. If I thought it could help, I'd let you testify. But it wouldn't. It wouldn't help me. And it would certainly hurt you. I won't let you do it.
You know, another thing I like about this scene are the accents.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to imagine, Jeremy, like there was more like gunplay going on in 1915 in Salt Lake City. But the accents were thicker then too, right?
Yeah, the neighborhood that all these people were living in Murray was predominantly Swedish. Like the little movie theater on State Street down there played like it was a Swedish movie house. They, you know, the police talked about how they had a hard time investigating down there because none of them spoke Swedish, which that gets me onto a whole new thing that I won't talk about. But anyway, you know, there were little pockets all over the valley of different nationalities.
Yeah.
And
you see, and that's yet another resonance with today.
Yeah.
The role of immigrants in society and what American society thinks about immigrants.
Okay. This gets to the big question. I wanted to have you talk a little bit about this. Why didn't he say anything? I mean, on one hand, maybe he's trying to protect a friend. Maybe he's trying to protect a woman that he loved. There's also some sense that and Jeremy, I think this is something for you that's a big deal. Joe Hill didn't say anything because why would he have any reason to trust the establishment?
I think that's correct because and there's plenty of modern corollaries for this. Like, you know, he's an immigrant. He's a member of a far left radical group that is hated. you know, everywhere he goes, the police are, they're all over these guys. Like some of the things that happen, they just beggar belief. And so when the police and the governor and all these folks who are the enemy are telling him, oh, just tell us what happened. You can trust us. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
If there's one group he's not going to listen to and trust, it's them. And it's because of his experience in this country. You know, it's, So to me, like that speaks volumes about why he wouldn't have spoken up. Like I think you have to take who he was and put it in the political context of the West. Why on earth would he speak up? Yeah. You know, we see that today, like, you know, immigrants, refugees, whatever, you know, why would you talk to the police? You talk to the police, things are harder. You know, like if you're an undocumented immigrant and somebody commits a crime against you, you're not going to report it because when the police shows up, who's in trouble? You are.
Right.
You know, it's that kind of an idea.
Yeah, because you have to presume that the establishment is going to treat you fairly. And he didn't at all assume that.
Yeah. And I think that's Joe's silence doesn't make sense if you're in the mainstream of America.
Yeah.
If you're outside of it, it makes perfect sense.
What about you? What do you think?
I totally agree with that. In fact, I think it was Virginia Snow Stevens, yet another one of the fascinating characters that didn't make it into the play, who said—
Daughter of a Mormon prophet, by the
Lorenzo
way.
Lorenzo Snow.
Sort of titillate people, but keep going.
I think it was her who at once said, never underestimate the fear of the police in outsider groups, something to that effect. I think I've built that into the play. At one point, Joe actually kind of turns to us and says, was I right not to trust them? You know, because they were leaking all sorts of things that were supposed to be confidential. And then the only thing I would add to what Jeremy says is at some point, I think he figured out that being a martyr was going to do a lot more for the Wobblies than being stuck in prison for the rest of his life or being pardoned, and was willing to do that, was willing to be a martyr.
Deborah Threedy, she's a playwright, legal scholar. She wrote One Big Union, now playing at Plan B Theater Company. It runs through Sunday. All of the performances are sold out. There is a wait list for each show, so you have a chance. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Deborah, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Doug.
And Jeremy Harmon with the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been writing about Joe Hill. He's planning a book. Glad you could be with us as well.
Glad to be here.
Thanks a lot. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Emily Anderson is our intern. Special thanks today to KUER's Michael Havey. We have technical direction always from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.